It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Well, good evening. This is John McMullen welcoming you to this week's episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. Our most recent column for Westchester Guardian is at website www.westchesterguardian.com. It is 157th column in the Creative Disruption series. I hope you'll read the column, enjoy them, and if need be, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. You'll find links to the previous radio shows and to my online daily newspaper at my web home. Try it and subscribe to the papers on one email per day, and that's www.johnmack13.com. The list of upcoming shows is also at the site. My guest next week is author Norm Vonnegut, but I hope you'll join us then. Now to this show, the 84th in the series. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. But I do hold the online participation of callers to near the conclusion of my interview with my guest. So once again, that's 646-716-9756. My guest tonight is scientist and famed science fiction author David Brin. While David is best known for his fiction writing, he's prolific in expressing his ideas on a wide range of subjects in TED Talks, videos, and essays. His website, www.davidbrin.com, is a good starting point in appreciating the far reaches of his mind. That's www.davidbrin.com. As frequent listeners know, they usually start at the beginning of the guest's life to move forward. Tonight, as it's possible that David may have to depart early at some point, I'm going to deviate somewhat from my normal procedure to ensure that I touch on some points of interest to me and I hope to the audience. Good evening, David, and welcome to the show.
Hi, John, and well, hi to everybody else out there.
In 1999, when the concerns about technology as an invader of privacy were just really heating up, you published The Transparent Society, Will Technology Force Us to Choose Between Privacy and Freedom? The book, certainly unique at the time, brought you the American Library Association Freedom of Speech Award. Now, 16 years later, and following the Edward Snowden revelations, there is much more public awareness and interest in the interplay between government, surveillance, security, and privacy. Could you summarize your findings and recommendations from the early book and tell us what the ensuing years have modified your analysis?
Well, the biggest problem I have is frustration that we have a civilization that all of our apologies, all of our films preach suspicion of authority. And people on the left rightfully fear conniving attempts to become Big Brother on the part of oligarchs and aristocrats and faceless corporations. People on the right legitimately fear attempts to become Big Brother on the part of snooty academics and faceless government bureaucrats. You know, the basic instinct underlying it is correct on both sides. The Big Brother could come from any of those directions. So the biggest frustration has been that we have ourselves, at the urging of potential Big Brothers, destroyed politics in the United States of America. So we don't negotiate with each other anymore. We don't politically accept the idea. You may be right about my elites, and I might be right about your elites. So let's watch all of them together. Instead, each of us seems own trip. His own trip is the only way to go. Well, when it comes to preserving privacy and informational freedom, this is even worse because what people have done is they go into rants about Snowden, about the NSA, about this and that and the other, and they always claim that this is going to lead to Big Brother, and they're absolutely right, it could. But they never have a suggestion, never have a single practical suggestion what to do about it. If you pass a law that says that NSA won't look, shouldn't look, those operations and those projects will simply go to someplace darker. Have you ever played the game Whack-A-Mole at the amusement park? Whack one mole down, another comes up. In 2003, we whack-a-moled something called Total Information Awareness, TIA. Everybody should look it up. And everybody was so proud of themselves because we stopped John Poindexter and Total Information Awareness. Well, it just went to the NSA, we later found out. No, you're not going to accomplish anything by trying to stop elites from looking at us. Across the last 6,000 years, that methodology has never worked. There is another that might work. It happens to be the one that got us the freedom and privacy we have today. But it's been very frustrating trying to get people to look at that method. It's not impossible. The Transparent Society is one of the very few public policy books from the 20th century, still in print, still selling more every year. Influential people read it, you know, and it gets awards. But the basic thing it tries to say is apparently so difficult that most of our pundits just ignore even the possibility of something called surveillance. If surveillance is the elites looking at us from above, then you go to the same language, French, and use S-O-U-S. That means, surveillance means looking back at the mighty from below. And this is just apparently just too difficult a concept for most people.
About 10 years after the transparency, in 2008, Washington Post investigator Bob O'Hara published No Place to Hide, bringing the earliest notice of big data and the works of the amalgamated, such as Axiom, to the general public. For those who haven't paid attention, everything we do in the digital world and much of the physical world is collected, be it credit card purchases, supermarket, drugstore, another bonus point, social media postings, easy pass, credit, mortgage, marital, divorce, and criminal history, location information. And it's combined into profiles and by Axiom and other companies, which may be then sold to prospective employers, graduate schools, law enforcement agencies. And parenthetically, the law enforcement agencies could not, by law, gather the information themselves, but as far as I know, can use the gathered Axiom data. You predicted a lot of this. What do you say now that it's become true?
Well, yes, I did predict it, and it's inevitable. Never in history have elites refused to use a method to look around themselves, and there's a reason for this. They're descended from monkeys, just like you and me. I'd like you to go down, any of your viewers, go down to the local zoo, tell them I sent you, pick up a stick, climb into the baboon enclosure, and poke out the eyes of the biggest baboon. Here's a hint. The biggest baboon will not let you his eyes, but he will let you look at him. We can't poke out the eyes of the mighty. It won't work. But what we can do is look at the mighty. We can strip the mighty naked. We can force them to accept accountability. Here's a fundamental. Let's say we make it illegal for the NSA or the government to collect this information, or Axiom to collect this information. Will you ever be sure that the law has worked? No. You can never, by any means known to man, verify that someone else does not know something. It's illogical. However, you can verify whether someone else is doing something to you. What matters is what elites can do, whether the banks can steal from you, whether the whether the criminals can steal from you, whether the government can take you away from your home and make you disappear. We have to prevent the things they might do to us first, and then worry about what they know about us. And the only way we can control what they might do to us is by looking at them, by stripping them naked. And by the way, that's the only way we can limit what they know also. If you want to limit what the NSA is looking at or what Axiom is looking at, you have to use my prescription first. You have to strip them naked. You have to see to it that they're supervised. And I don't see what's so hard about this concept to understand.
Now, with the NSA and the FBI and others, they hide things even under Freedom of Information Act, saying it's vital to national security. But should we have the right by law to know what Axiom and the other providers have put in their profiles about us?
Well, of course. Probably one of the best, most important laws that was passed a couple decades ago was the one that allowed us to see our credit reports. It's almost impossible today to imagine that there was a time when you could not see and suggest corrections to your credit report. And yet, when this law was being proposed, Experian and the other credit agencies claimed that it would cause the world to end. Consumers got to see their credit reports. This is the same thing. We should see what stores and commercial agencies and all those people, all those commercial units, are gathering about us. Now, the government has an excuse to keep things secret. It will, of course, use that excuse to try to keep things secret. In my novel Earth, I dealt with this. It was written in 1989, but it had web pages before there was a web, and a lot of other things. In fact, my fans keep a wiki to track the number of successful and unsuccessful predictions from just that one book. And there's a wiki, my overall predictive score, because I believe in that. I believe we should be scored by our predictions. But in Earth, I talk about how a reform made it so that any agency has to buy out of its budget security caches or secrecy that would be good for 5 years. If they want it for 10 years, it costs 10 times as much, and so on. So you have an economic incentive in the agency to clean up their backlog of old secrets. There are lots of ways we could be doing this. We could, for example, beef up the inspector general system in the government so that the inspectors general who are already security cleared, so that the CIA and all those agencies cannot complain about those people seeing what they're doing, take all the inspectors general. Right now, there's a corrupt situation. They owe their jobs, the department and agency secretaries who appointed. Instead, take all the inspectors general away, being beholden to their agency, and put them under a new office called the Inspector General of the United States, or IGUS. If that happened, and you could write that law in one page, if that happened overnight, all the inspectors general and all the different departments would be free of this conflict of interest. And we could all go to sleep that very night with maybe 5%, maybe 10% more trust in our government. Is that enough? Absolutely not, because one could imagine the inspectorate being corrupted. But we can find lots of win-win situations like this in which the civil servants are allowed to do their job, even some jobs in secret, but still we would have confidence that they are our watchdogs and they are not wolves. And if you meet these people, most of them are sincere civil servants. Most of them do not want to be wolves. But over time, secrecy will turn them, or their people who have their jobs after them, or the ones after that, will turn them into wolves unless there's a choke chain on them. And the choke chain has got to be us being able to supervise.
Have you seen any interest from lawmakers to advocate such policies? I haven't seen anything but the dysfunctional group we have in this area.
Well, the report, I know some people who did the report for President Obama on the Snowden revelations. And they sincerely tried their best to come up with ways to walk this line so that the NSA and the CIA and the FBI could continue to do their jobs while at the same time improving our accountability and eliminating some of the worst aspects of unaccountability. There were several reforms. For example, the FISA court. This was a so-called court in which they could get a secret search warrant to get metadata information from the phone companies about who was calling whom. And out of several hundred requests to this court, only a few, very few, were refused. I think something like a dozen. And it was pointed out, you know, how can it be a court? The very word court means that there's adversarial action involved. Somebody has to complain and force the government to make a case. And it was a fake court. Now, under this new reform, there is an ombudsman or a advocate whose job it is to question all of these requests for search warrants. And it has reduced the number of these search warrants. But it's still one person, and that one person could be suborned or part of the old boy network or whatever. I would like to see there be five or six such advocates, each of them with security clearances. Sure, they're well-known and they're very secure people who won't blab, but they're appointed by diverse groups, stakeholders in our nation, in our community. For instance, the ACLU should get to appoint one. Electronic Frontier Foundation should get to appoint one. In other words, they would be very, very circumspect people, security clearances. But they would also be people who are suspicious of overreach on the part of the prosecutors. You can see what I'm trying to do here. I'm trying to come up with ways to improve the give and take that is the normal way that we got our freedom. To the people who wave their arms around like the robot in Lost in Space and say, it's all ending, freedom is ending, and all of that, they never stop to think, how did we get the freedom we already have? And it's different than the last 6,000 years. And we got that freedom by the very methods that I'm describing.
One of the interesting comments that I had on this, and it was by Mark Rausch, who was the person that set up the Department of Justice Computer Crime Task Force back in the early 1990s. And we were speaking about this after he had been on television, and something came out of one of the programs. He was an early guest on the radio show. And he believed in many of the things that the government was doing to protect us, but his feeling was that the problem is the total lack of transparency. He said whenever these things are pointed out and someone goes to the FBI or the NSA or to someone and they say, you've been doing these things. Have they prevented anything? How many people have you caught? How many have you done this? They say, that's classified. So he said, you can never debate whether the things that are being done that they're worth the problems that they might be creating for us. And as long as you don't have the transparency that you're talking about, that we're never going to be able to resolve these issues. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but we can resolve these issues if we were to go with the sensible approach of allowing people, advocates and people who question the government, to participate in the appointing of trusted intermediaries.
Okay.
The reason we can't see the details of these stories about the how often they've stopped terrorism is because they don't want the terrorists to get their methods. So they can't publicly let news reporters or average people know about this stuff. Fine. Then let's come up with procedures by which people who are naturally adversarial about this issue, like the ACLU and so on, can appoint people who are in between, who they trust to ask difficult questions, but who the government trusts not to tell the terrorists. See, what we're facing here is a more general problem, and it's the problem of the distinction between the zero sum game and the positive sum game. And if I can leave your listeners with only one concept out of this, if you do not understand the concept of the positive sum game, then you're not qualified to be a citizen of a 21st century republic. And almost none of our fellow citizens think about this concept. And I don't have time to instruct you about it now. So just look it up. Zero sum game, positive sum game. There is a book by Robert Wright called Non-Zero. And if you understand the concept, then you understand the notion of the win-win, where we can both improve our security and our freedom. And the most despicable thing in all of this discussion is this notion of a trade-off, that in order to have more security, we have to give up freedom, or that in order to preserve freedom, we're going to have to give up some security and safety. When the whole record of American life in the last 100 years has been a steady rise in both. You get both at the same time, or you get neither. And people have got to look for these insane zero-sum games that were being sold. Like, for instance, the Fox News narrative that that the only way we could possibly do anything about climate change is by destroying the economy, shutting down all the power plants, and sitting and shivering in the dark, and claiming that people on the other side actually want that, which is, of course, a complete lie, like everything that's said on that network. And I could point to some things on the left. The notion, that you see a lot of on the left, this whole anti-vaxxer thing, although that actually that craziness spans the entire spectrum. And I know I've got a number of your listeners livid right now, probably busting a blood vessel right now. But the fact of the matter is, we've got to rise above this stupid notion of zero-sum games. If we start doing that, then we'll restore politics in the United States of America, which has been deliberately killed. We don't have politics. It is the method by which we deal with problems, large macroscopic problems, or fine-tuning our culture, and this whole method has been robbed from us. It's been taken from us, as if by an enemy.
That was the point of the larger piece, the larger that we've just been talking about, that you wrote in 2004, when you struck out at this right-left ideological battle with your publication of The Lions for the Modern World, the paper that suggests 7 points which modernist defenders of the Enlightenment might be able to come together and solve. What started you down this path? What type of reaction have you received?
Very little. You know, I'm at a level of influence and fame where I can have dinner with billionaires and agency guys and all that sort of thing. But when you get right down to it, it's an intermediate and very frustrating level. You know, I can talk about these ideas. You know, the Transparent Society was published. It's still in print. It's still selling, you know, wins an occasional award. And guess what? You know, the really influential pundits of the right and left do not want the right-left axis abandoned. It's insane, it's lobotomizing, but it's in their best interest that it keep going. So they interview me, and they say, people say it's very interesting, but, you know, no one wants to escape from the left-right axis, even though it's stupid and none of your listeners could define it if their life depended on it. Sit down right now, or after the show is over, write down in a few sentences what left versus right means and see if it's the same definition that your neighbors or friends give. No two definitions will be alike. It's insane. And we base our politics in a sophisticated, technological, scientific civilization, 21st century, on that? We should abandon it if for no other reason. Here's the best reason to abandon it, because it's French. That was a joke.
That was a joke. You specifically mentioned in the piece the late William Buckley and Gary Wills and Al Gore and George Will, people who are identified on the right or the left, but you seem to think they were the type of people who would be able to work together in this type of defending of the Enlightenment. Why them specifically?
Well, look, left-right is not totally useless. It serves as a, especially in times like these when we're in a reignited American Civil War. It just doesn't mean what we used to think it meant. Go back to what I said at the very beginning. You cannot name a popular film you've enjoyed across the last 30 years in which the principal message that was being taught was not suspicion of authority. The principal hero has to deal with an authority figure, abuse by an authority figure. In almost every film, even chick flick romances, other memes that are spread in these in films are tolerance, suspicion of authority, individual eccentricity. Almost always the protagonist that you're supposed to identify with shows some eccentric trait. So we all believe that we are champions against Big Brother. The most effective science fiction novel of all time was 1984, which, you know, the you know, the metaphor to prevent Big Brother is in all of us. And people on the left don't appreciate that people on the right are just as scared of Big Brother as they are. They just think Big Brother is coming from snooty academics and faceless government bureaucrats. And the left people aren't afraid of those elites. Well, guess what? People on the right do not credit the people on the left with also equally being afraid of Big Brother. It's just the people on the left are afraid that that Big Brother is conniving to take over from the oligarchs and aristocrats who dominated every single human culture except for ours across 6,000 years and want to reinstall feudalism, and this is happening, or from faceless corporations. Well, if you look at it that way, both sides are right to worry about all of those accumulations of power, because cheaters might use any or all of those to become Big Brother. And the really insane thing is that we don't acknowledge this fact. And I happen to believe that one side of this stupid spectrum is more dangerous right now than the other. But the other one used to be dangerous, and it could be again. As a matter of fact, if the aristocrats and oligarchs succeed in recreating feudalism, the left will rise. You honestly think that these people are smart, these people who are trying to restore feudalism are smart, when they have no idea, apparently, what this will lead to? It'll lead to a French-style revolution. That's what it'll lead to. No, they're not smart.
Now, you had the longer piece, The Real Culture War, published the same year, the one Into the Background, what got us into this mess. Then you touch on the harmfulness of indignation, which became part of the focus of a 2014 TED Talk, Indignation, Addiction, and Hope. Does it help us to be mad as hell? Would you flush that subject out for us?
Yeah, well, you know, what is the theme song, the theme chant of the baby boomer generation? It's really quite simple. It's, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. You know, most of you have heard of that chant, even if you've never seen the wonderful, wonderful movie that it comes from called Network, and
right.
You really have to. It's one of the greatest movies of all time, and it is all about the sickness of sanctimony. And everybody got the wrong lesson. Everybody came out of that movie chanting what the insane man yells during the movie. And we embraced it and made it the theme of an entire American generation. I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. And I am as mad as hell and not going to take it anymore with that bull. I mean, things keep getting better so much faster than they're getting worse, in so many more ways than they're getting worse. All the toys we have, all the comforts we have, our lifespan, the air can now be breathed again. Even in L.A., Steven Pinker, in a book called The Better Angels of Our Nature, I hope you'll link to it from your website, as well as my book, The Transparent Society, and my latest novel, Existence, which has a three-minute video trailer that's the most fun you'll have in 3 minutes with your clothes on. And John will link to that wonderful trailer, and so much for the commercial break there. The point is that Steven Pinker's book shows explicitly that per capita, statistically, violence has been plummeting every decade since 1945. Yes, there are hot spots. There are terrible danger spots around the world. But on average, every decade, millions more children bring school books home to apartments with electricity and hot and cold running water. The good news is spectacular. So why can't we leverage on this? The left hates to hear the good news because it might reduce our intensity of the need to save the world. And that's a crazy response. Of course, if we got good news, we'd say, let's redouble what's working. And that's what the right is afraid of. They're terrified that people will realize that all sorts of great progressive things in the past have worked and are making the world a better place. And God probably isn't going to end it when we're doing so well. So there's a kind of insanity loose where we're unable to hear or notice or see the possibility that things might be getting better and that by negotiating with each other, we might make things better. Even faster. I'm glad you mentioned that YouTube thing because it ends with showing people just the things that they had done in space in the year 2013. And with pocket change from each citizen. And challenging them to go to the window, open the window, and shouting, I'm as proud as hell. I'm a member of a civilization that does shit like this. And that's harder because sanctimony and self-righteousness is so addictive. And if you want proof of that, look at me. Listen, replay the last 3 minutes of my rant. And I am a typical baby boomer, full of himself, sure he has everything sussed, and sanctimoniously ranting because he's mad as hell. It happens that the thing I'm mad as hell about is people being mad as hell. And if you have the ability to look at that irony and smile, maybe even chuckle a little bit, then you are a citizen of the 21st century. Wake up. Stop letting the merchants of fear mess up our ability to negotiate with each other.
Speaking of God, which you just did a minute ago, you've been part of the close to Truth series on the web, and you've given two interesting talks on the question, can we have religion without God? How did you get into this? And please give us insights into your thinking on the subject.
Well, right now we have the atheist agnostic position is being held up by people like Dennett and Dawkins and Hitchens and people like that who feed into the narrative of the zero sum. You have to be passionately mad as hell on one extreme view or the other. And this is what the media does. I mentioned, you know, Fox, they're the experts at this, but other media too are merchants of fear and merchants of simplistic screaming. But in fact, those who question past religion don't have to be irreligious. They don't have to be militant atheists. I'm not an atheist, but I believe that it's very clear that if God does exist, he's preaching a sermon every single day, and that is the sermon of ambiguity. He doesn't open the sky Monty Python style and tell us what he wants. Instead, he leaves it to us to improve as if he didn't exist. And I think that's a very important sermon. And in this, I gave a TED-style talk to the Singularity people, and many of your members of your audience have heard of the Singularity. It's the notion that we might, through brain enhancements or the creating of artificial intelligence, we might become more godlike ourselves in not too distant future, perhaps 20 years. Now, is your reaction to that assertion anger? Is your reaction an assurance that such hubris will be punished or that God will end it all before that can happen? Well, take a look at the last time we supposedly challenged the powers of God. It was the Tower of Babel. And most people pay no attention, most theologians pay no attention to the story of the Tower of Babel. But if you actually read the scripture, no anger at all, God isn't even slightly angry. He decides to stop the tower and disperse us. But a page earlier, he was angry enough to destroy the entire world. A page later, he pours fire and brimstone on people who sold their daughters to be whores. But in the Tower of Babel, all he does is scatter people. And here is what he says. He says, look at them. They continue on this course. Nothing will be beyond them. And the theological implications are stunning. It's God saying that we were made so that nothing is beyond us. And I mean the word nothing because that's where the word that's used. If nothing is beyond us, then that means we were made to be apprentice creators, because what else would we choose to do but enter into Dad's profession? Now, that's a very unusual theological thing to say, and yet it's right there. What was the one moment in the Bible where God treats us with respect and collegial courtesy without threats or any of the redemption stuff? It's when he asks Adam to name the beasts, which also is a metaphor for science, because a page earlier, God was using naming to create everything. So he's giving his apprentice a creation task. And now we're doing that. We're naming beasts. We're just right now, this week, naming the craters of the dwarf planet Ceres. In 2 months, we'll be naming the craters of Pluto as the New Horizons ship sweeps by.
I'm one of the few people, and it's perhaps that I don't understand Teilhard well enough, but I'm one of the few people that does not see the great conflict between the singularity and Teilhard's vision of the evolution of human beings toward the point omega. To me, they both make sense together. Have you followed Teilhard at all? Teilhard's thinking?
De Chardin. He spoke of the noosphere. He spoke of the inevitability of humanity arising up and joining God in skill. And at the time, he barely escaped being labeled a heretic. Now, this idea is one that is fairly straightforward. and a number of people believe it to be the case. And I just supported it with a couple of pieces of scripture that I think he did not. But the point is, that's using logic. That's using passion and ideas. That's using a science fiction story, which essentially is what he did there. What we're doing is we're now augmenting that with actually making it happen. And people who are zero-sum in their thinking, who have a nostalgic and romantic worldview, are very upset by this concept. They believe that it is hubris. They believe that the people trying to build the Tower of Babel were sinners, not just trying to do something too early. And the reason is pretty clear. Throughout human history, 99% of cultures put their golden age in the past, a mythology about a golden age in the past when people were better, they were closer to God, and then fell from that state of grace, usually because of hubris. Well, if that's the case, then anybody who tries to rise back up to, toward that state of grace by their own actions or by in this world is resuming that hubris, like eating of the tree of knowledge. And that's terrifying. And so many of our neighbors believe that God will end it all before we achieve that point. And you don't just see this troglodytic look back to a golden age, romantic nostalgia on the right. There are a fair number of people who are, have that same personality on the left, only they think that it was an Earth Mother, Gaia, or tribal ways are better than high tech. It's less uniform on the left. Such people are more anomalous and a smaller minority on that side of the spectrum. Most people on that side of the spectrum are moderate liberals. But the left does contain such people who are just as nostalgic and romantic and terrified of us reaching for godlike powers just as much as the larger group of people who feel that way on the right.
Don't we seem to have, though, a difficult time looking at the complexity of things? Like it's been pointed out, the technology, which I'm a technologist, and I have been since I was the programmer back in the early 60s, that for the first time that we see technology and robotics and AI really eating employment, and we don't seem to notice that all of the savings that we make, at some point there won't be people to buy the material. Do we have to look at this globally as a problem rather than just ignoring it? There's very few people who are looking at the impacts of technology and jobs and everything. We don't seem to do complexity well anymore.
We're doing complexity better than we ever did before. It's just that it's getting complex faster than it ever did before. Look, the burden of proof is on those who say that we couldn't have jobs as we're getting more technological, because so much of the wealth, the productivity, United States of America, has risen prodigiously since 1945.
Right.
And until the late 70s or early 80s, most of the gains in productivity went to the wages of the middle class. So we had this powerful diamond-shaped social structure. After around 1980, most of the gains in productivity went to the top of the pyramid. And the worry is that this is resulting in our diamond-shaped social structure that has always, the dream has been of a powerful middle class that's empowered and unafraid of the rich and that outnumbers the poor, that this diamond-shaped social structure with churn and who you're going to be when you grow up isn't automatically determined by your parents' social status, that this will get pounded back into the old feudal pyramid, the pyramid that dominated almost every human culture until our recent 200-year-old enlightenment started trying something else. This is what I fear. This is what a lot of people fear. If we have a diamond-shaped social structure, when automation hits, what it's going to do is it's going to mean that everybody's home will have these maker machines, and you'll be able to make anything you want in your home. And yes, fewer people will have jobs because of that. But that won't result in you being poor, because you'll have a Star Trek replicator just about in your room, and you'll have to do what they do in Star Trek, and that is find other ways to spend your time than slaving away, earning the money to buy stuff. If we have a pyramidal social structure, it happens, then what we'll do is we'll go back to grinding poverty with people who don't have any jobs and who want jobs desperately because they're poor. And that will be how the rich will keep us under control. Now, nobody listening to me right now is going to be able to tell what my politics are for sure. Sure, I oppose is on both sides, and I think one side is crazier and more dangerous right now. I think we have a reignited American Civil War, and it's not so much right and left, it's Confederacy. But you're not going to be able to tell me what I think about capitalism. I happen to like capitalism, but it has to be flat, to be open, it has to be fair, and it has to not have cheaters running it.
That seems to require some analysis, though, as you've obviously done, and we see very little analysis, even with our non-politicians. There are very few people. You mentioned Robert Reich earlier. He's written about this, but there are very few people that are pounding on the door saying we have to look at this anyhow, no matter what the solution is. Our Congress can't agree on a debt limit 2 weeks away. How do we get around these things?
Well, politics has been destroyed in the United States of America. I believe it's been done deliberately, and I think there is no act of war that could possibly merit us getting nuclear-level angry at the people who did it. Because politics is a method by which we negotiate with each other. We find mixed solutions using both the state and private enterprise and individuals supporting themselves, and adjust the rules of the marketplace so that companies will get rich by satisfying more modern needs. Politics, it has this horrible name, but giving it this horrible name is part of the reason why politics has been destroyed. People should Google an article from Slate magazine by David Auerbach. That's Auerbach. Just came out. Buyers Still Beware, and it's about the subtleties of capitalism and how limited knowledge is a problem that economists are very serious about. And in theory, we should have a system in which the more participants are wise and know the most about the system, the better, and that they'll make good decisions. But
how do we get back to the Lyndon Johnson, Everett Dirksen days, or the Tip O'Neill, Ronald Reagan days, but they could talk to each other, and it didn't seem to be this hate? And also, how do we inform people who all seem too busy now to want anything more than the Fox soundbites or the MSC soundbites that you mentioned? How do we do this?
We have got to demand more. And we have to notice when politics does work. There was only one time in the last 50 years when a Republican Congress cooperated with a Democratic president. It's gone the other way sometimes. Nixon got some of his things he wanted. Reagan got some of the things he wanted. Heck, both Bushes got some of the things they wanted from Democratic Congresses. But one year, 1995, an anno mirabilis, a miracle year, Gingrich paused in his war against Bill Clinton, and for one year they negotiated. And we got miracles. We got welfare reform. We got the Budget Act, which led to huge surpluses and the best economy in the history of the Republic. And Gingrich's reward was to be attacked and then fired by Hastert, DeLay, Boehner, and the other new radicals in the Republican Party, who swore openly, they said it for the record in front of the press, this will never happen again. We will never, ever again cooperate with a Democratic president. And when Obama tried to negotiate with them by giving them their plan for health care, he abandoned Hillary's plan, he abandoned all the Democratic Party's plans, and took the Heritage Foundation, Romney, Massachusetts plan for health care, the Republicans' official party platform, for 6 years, put it on the table. They called it Obamacare, and not one Republican in Congress be brought to the negotiating table to even talk about modifying their own plan. Am I saying that the left is automatically right? Of course not. In fact, I don't even think left-right has anything to do with it anymore. I mean, how can you say that it's a matter of left and right when it's the Democrats who deregulate that old government? They deregulated the Interstate Commerce Commission, the Civil Aeronautics Board, trucking, communications, broke up AT&T, started the cell phone era. Bill Clinton deregulated GPS so we could all use it. Al Gore deregulated, and
Bill Clinton took away Sarbanes-Oxley, which is probably a very big mistake.
Yes. There were definitely mistakes. But just look across the country and see which states are pulling back from the horrible, awful drug war. It's all blue states. There's not one red state doing that. So I don't think it's about old-fashioned left or right or who's in favor of capitalism or not. If you look at the map, it's very clearly one thing, and that is a reignition of the American Civil War. And the map is pretty clear about that. But in any event, I didn't mean to get off on politics.
That's fine. On a different topic, your most well-known on the 1980s novel was The Postman, well-known because of its winning both the Campbell and the Locus Awards and the Kevin Costner movie based on it. Published rumors held that you weren't happy with the movie adaptation. What's the real story in your experience with the adaptation?
Other guys have had worse experiences. Of course, Philip K. Dick had a much better experience. He got Blade Runner. But it's also a matter of personality. You remember what I said about not wanting to be mad as hell? Even though, of course, I'm an addict and I do get mad as hell, but I don't like it as a long-term feeling. I look for reasons to be happy. And whereas Costner wasn't at all friendly to me, he didn't buy the original author of the original novel a beer, not even a beer. But despite the fact that he was a real schmuck, let's just face facts. The man is a brilliant cinematographer, probably one of the best who ever lived. Dances with Wolves, The Postman, Open Range, the ones he directed are among the most beautiful motion pictures ever shot. And despite what I think of him personally, he captured the heart essence of my book, its basic story, its basic character, the lesson that it wants to teach. So if the heart is there and it's beautiful, I can forgive the fact that the last third of the movie is incredibly dumb. So, I have a balanced attitude. Personally, I think anybody should go and watch that film stoned. It's simply a feast. It's beautiful and it'll make you cry. Just try not to think too much. And then when you want to think about the issues that are raised in the movie, buy the book.
I did both. I had read the book long before I saw the movie. Your most recent book, Existence, also contains exploration of possible future trends that might transform our world. Would you speak about the book? And it's available, as you mentioned earlier, as Allworks mentioned tonight, are on Amazon.
Well, also, you can order them straight from my website, davidbrin.com. After you've watched the 3-minute video trailer for Existence, which has just gorgeous art by the brilliant web artist Patrick Farley, who I highly recommend you go to his website, Electric Sheep Comics. But the Existence is one of my 2 books for grown-ups. It's set in the fairly near future. If you set a story in the very near future, it's very easy to write, like Michael Crichton. You just take today's world and you change it with one small thing, and then you put everything back after a few people have been killed. The distant future is like playing tennis with the net down, and so but you can have some science in the distant future, like my novels, my Uplift novels about dolphins in space, you know, uplifting creatures, was humanity uplifted? And it's the intermediate range from 30 to 50 years that's so hard. You have to try to extrapolate future trends and yet be plausibly based on this world. So this one, there's an astronaut fishes something in out of deep space, and it is kind of scary. It's the most unusual alien encounter story that I think you're likely to come across. But it's mostly about us in 30 years, the many ways in which our kids might be better than us, and a few ways in which they might have made terrible mistakes.
I remember Bruce Sterling's Islands in the Net in the late 80s, and it really had the internet and even Google Glasses long before there was a World Wide Web with everyone was connected, and you don't get many things like that that tend to get it right, as you mentioned, in the near future.
Yeah, well, it can be, hazardous to explore the future. I mean, all the pitfalls and the landmines and all those things. But in any event, I must take my leave. At this point, I have some things I have to take care of that I actually have simmering and waiting 10 minutes ago. This was so interesting.
I mentioned earlier that you might have to leave early. Thank you very much. And is there anything else before you run that you'd like the audience to know about David Brin?
Well, yeah, I'm sure that you'll post a bunch of my YouTubes. If any of you have a kid going off to college, John will post my famous riff on how they can double the benefits from their college experience. And, there's another that I did for the Smithsonian about how we may, if we don't meet aliens, we might make them. So with that, I'll take my leave and wish you and John and your listeners all the best. And let's hope we can get back to being a people who negotiate with each other again. You know, accept the notion that your passionate opponents, even if they're 90% wrong, that leaves 10% you could learn from them. And best of luck to us all.
Thank you very much, David. It's been a real pleasure.
All right. Bye, John.
Bye now. A bit of commercial information. My column appears weekly in Rest's The Guardian, along with regular columns by ex-congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, critic John Simon, and historian Daniel Pipes. Rest's The Guardian is available in print format and online at www.restsoftheguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at johnmack13.johnmackrants.com. And send any comments or questions to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in the book. Go to my website, www.johnmack13.com, for the URLs and the schedule of upcoming shows. Tune in next week for my conversation with author Norm Vonnegut. Until then, as they used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Steady, Silver, steady.
Okay.